Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, welcome everyone to this LSE public event to mark the launch of the new book by Liam Byrne, Why Populists Are Winning and How to Beat Them. So in this rather quiet, uneventful week for UK politics, it's great that so many of you could be here with us tonight, both in person and online. My name's Andy Summers. I'm an associate professor in the law school here at LSE and director of the Centre for Analysis of Taxation, a topic that we might get to at some point in this evening's discussions. Liam will appreciate if I say right away that copies of his book will be available to buy outside the lecture theatre after this event, and indeed you can even get your copy signed by Liam. But first, we have a wonderful lineup of speakers to present and debate the book, so let me introduce them. Liam Byrne is the Labour MP for Birmingham, Hodge Hill and Solihull North, a member of the Privy Council and chair of the House of Commons Business and Trade Select Committee. He's also an influential figure within the Tribune Group of Labour MPs. But beyond all these impressive affiliations, he's also a deep thinker in his own right. He has written, by my count, no less than five sole-authored books, and his latest has been received, I think it's fair to say, with some critical acclaim. Tonight, I expect we'll hear both acclaim and criticism, as we'd rightly expect from an audience at LSE, and I'm really looking forward to it. To kick off that discussion, after Liam has presented his book, I'm delighted that we also have with us Zoe Williams and Sarah Hobolt to offer their reactions and thoughts. Zoe has been a columnist for The Guardian since the year 2000, before which she wrote for the London Evening Standard. Her broadcasting experience spans Question Time, Newsnight, Channel 4 News and Dispatches, and the Today programme, so I'm sure she will not be daunted by this evening's audience. She's also author of several books, including Get It Together, Why We Deserve Better Politics, The Madness of Modern Parenting, and Bring It On Baby. Sarah Hobolt is the Sutherland Chair in European Institutions, and the head of the Department of Government here at LSE. She's also the president of the European Political Science Society and the chair of the European Election Studies. Sarah's research focuses on elections, referendums, public opinion, and political parties. In her forthcoming book, Tribal Politics, How Brexit Divided Britain, she examines how the Brexit vote gave rise to new political identities in Britain. So ideally placed, I think, to comment on Liam's book. So before we get underway, just a few logistics. This event's being recorded, and hopefully it'll be made available later as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. We're not expecting any fire alarms, so if one occurs, please do take it seriously and follow the steward's instructions. LSE is committed to free speech, and that means being open for debate, which we will do via the questions, but also respecting our panellists' right to speak. So as I mentioned, there'll be a chance for audience Q&A after our panellists have spoken. We'll aim to preserve about 30 or 40 minutes at the end for that, and I'll explain the format for fielding questions when we get to that part of the event. So in the meantime, it remains for me to reiterate how pleased we are to have Liam here and say over to you, Liam.
Brilliant. Great.
Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, great. Okay, great. Andy, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming. It is a busy time. We have very thoughtfully organised this kind of sideshow just down the road in Westminster, just to help make sure that it pops tonight. Not the Prime Minister, the event. So thank you very much for coming, and I think we'll probably get into some of the kind of overlap between the topics that we're going to talk about tonight and what's going on down the road. But I have to say that for the purpose of this evening, as Lyndon Johnson once said, it is a real privilege to be someone who can escape the turmoil of our capital down the road for the calm of your campus. And it's brilliant, Andy, if I may say, to be here with you. You've been a huge influence on me the work that you did on the Wealth Tax Commission, in particular with Aaron and the team, is something that I tried to kind of feature in the prequel to this, The Inequality of Wealth. And Zoe and Sarah, for those of you who don't know their work, is just right at the cutting edge of some of the kind of debates that we've got to navigate as a nation. So the starting point, I suppose, for this book is this cast list of characters. And the book was begun in 2024 when we had this great democratic moment. So 2024, 2 billion people go to vote. And I think it's fair to say that the populists were amongst the biggest winners. Now, nothing is forever, including political office. And of course, one of these folks is already out of office. But I suppose if there's a provocation that I wanted to start the book with, it was this. This great, extraordinary democratic outcome from 2 billion people going to vote has left us with about a quarter of the world's democracies run by authoritarian populists or populists on the right. Yet I think the questions for those of us in the mainstream of politics is this populism's peak, or actually is it the tipping point? And I think after the results that we had last week, notwithstanding the fact that reform's vote came down a bit, many people would say that in fact we may not yet be at peak populism. And I think we have to take that seriously, because when you look at three of the big secular trends which help explain the politics of today, they're not going to diminish in force in the years to come. If anything, they're going to go stronger. So, as I'll explain in a bit, the kind of pressure on living standards, the inequality of progress that has bedeviled so many Western countries, can any one of us really anticipate that diminishing in the years to come? Actually, could the spread of artificial intelligence not hold down wages further in the years to come? Could we actually see a disillusionment with the global economy grow deeper rather than get easier? Second, the great divides that we have in our society today, accelerated no doubt by social media, but also the evisceration of social capital in so many of our communities, that too could accelerate in the years to come. And finally, this kind of new age of human movement that populists exploit with such success, well, that too could become a more pronounced feature of our politics in the years to come. The World Bank thinks that over the next 10 to 15 years, about 1.2 billion people will join the labour market in the emerging economies. But at best, those economies will grow maybe 400 million jobs. So what is going to happen to the 800 million people who are also in search of the quiet miracle of a normal life? So there's a good case to say that many of these trends actually may grow stronger in the years to come. And of course, what history teaches us is that they really come to sharp focus when there's a crash. And who amongst us would rule out a New York Stock Exchange crash over the years to come? That's a serious moment. New York Stock Exchange today is about 40% of global equity values. If that crashes, at a moment when economies around the world are already tapped out at high levels of debt, then it could well be possible, foreseeable even, that you get an economic moment that tips over into a moment of political extremism. So it's not hard to paint a picture. It's not hard to imagine a scenario in which populism becomes actually more advanced rather than less in the years to come. This is not going to fix itself. That's the message for mainstream politics. Mainstream politics has to get a grip of this. And so what the book tries to do is a couple of things. So there's lots of great work on the demand side of populism, and we add to that library by, in particular, doing some work on a kind of a big segmentation study of reform voters. And I should apologise up front and say this is a book about right-wing populism. The paperback, which will be coming out a bit later on in the year, I can see now is going to have a chapter on left-wing populism, but for now you'll have to content yourself with the story about populism on the right. But we kind of get into just trying to kind of understand the market for populism in a bit more detail. But then what I felt as a politician is that the supply side of populism was much understudied. And so we try and get into that by kind of unpacking some novel research into what is the message, what is the media, and crucially, what is the money and what's the magical thinking that helps glue this coalition together. Let me just sort of start off with this point, though, just to kind of set the stage. This is from Jane Green's work, who mentored me at Nuffield College. And it just kind of makes the point that still, by and large, reform and right-wing populism in Britain is a revolt on the right. So Labour is losing its vote in all kinds of directions at the moment, but we're losing more of our vote to Don't Know, to Green, to Independent, to Workers' Party than we are to reform. We're losing about 10% of our vote to reform. That number has probably stepped up a little bit, I would say, in the elections last week. But still, you know, what you're beginning to see now is this kind of bifurcation of British politics. The two-party system may be history, but the two-block system is now upon us, a right block and a left block, which basically reflect on how you voted in the referendum. Why is Reform winning? Because they're doing a better job consolidating the right block than Labour is doing at consolidating the left block. So you've got what we kind of call in Birmingham asymmetric fragmentation. You've got a big fragmentation of the progressive vote on the left, but actually the vote on the right is consolidating. The Reform vote we found, though, is not kind of one army marching in unison. There are actually four or five different tribes there. And so it's important to kind of understand what they have in common, but it's also really, really important to understand what differentiates them. And what we found through lots of polling work, my own work in my constituency, but also a very interesting and in-depth ethnographic study, is that by and large, Reform voters, we found, have got five things in common. Under pressure, often in their 50s, really struggling with the cost of living, but crucially not earning what they really think they should be earning given the hard work that has gone into their lives. Often they're disadvantaged in the labour market because they've left school early. There were often very good reasons for that: a parent dying, a caregiver lost, a family breaking up, that involved them having to kind of get out into the workplace and through sheer hard graft keep their noses above water over a lifetime's hard work, and now feel under acute economic pressure. Second, deeply pessimistic about the future. So a really significant chunk of Reform voters think that their wealth is going to decline over the next 10 years, and an overwhelming majority think that the next generation will definitely be worse off. Often living in precarious communities. You know, this kind of helps explain this kind of phenomenon of the working class leaving Labour. Actually, working class people live in working class communities, which were at the sharp end of austerity over the last 10 to 15 years and have not been sort of fixed over the last 2 years, explaining some of the sort of frustration. All of these things feel a sense of dispossession about their place in the queue, and therefore that fuels anger with immigration, and finally a fury with people like me and the political class. A real fury with the politics that they feel has let them down. But at the heart of it, I think, is this. And it's kind of what you call democracy's broken promise. So that old notion that if you work hard, play by the rules, you'll get on in life. Actually, for many, many people, that's not true anymore. It was the great promise of the globalisation that opened up in the glades after the Berlin Wall came down, that kind of defining moment of my political life. But actually, look at what's happened. So before the financial crash, wages were growing at about 1.7% a year. Now, what does that mean? That means basically that it takes 42 years for your wages to double. Since the financial crash, average wage growth across the OECD economies has collapsed, about 0.6% a year. That means it takes 109 years for your wages to double. So whereas once upon a time you could look forward to living standards basically doubling over the course of a lifetime, now it takes generations for the same kind of change to happen. But this has been coupled, and this is something Sarah and I have sort of thought about and talked about a bit. It's coupled with a kind of a collapse in social capital in lots and lots of communities around the country. So an overwhelming majority of Reform voters say that their area is in serious decline. 80% of extreme reform voters think that. They're net negative about the level of community spirit in their area, and they feel no sense of agency or control. And, you know, lots of us could tell stories about these kind of communities. High streets that are shuttered, local services that are shuttered, fly tipping all over the place. Nobody seems to really care about it. No one is doing anything about it. And when you've got that kind of destruction of social capital, the breakdown of those bonds that connect us, of course, it's far, far easier for people to be radicalised by social media and other forces. Flipping to the supply side then, I'll canter through this super quickly, Andy. So I wanted to start with the message because this is one of the things that I think political science underrates a lot. We spend an awful lot of time with politicians thinking about what to say. I know it doesn't often seem like that. I know it doesn't often present like that. But actually, a great deal of thought goes into sort of writing those speeches. It's not all ChatGPT, although that is changing. But equally, a lot of thought and effort goes into kind of writing the literature. So actually studying what politicians say is a clue to what they're to where they're coming from. So we kind of built this massive, great big library of popular speeches from Maloney and Le Pen and Orban and those crazy Dutch people and Trump and Mr. Farage and Mr. Tyres. And we basically ran it through this kind of semantic analysis, and I was just amazed at what emerged. So what emerged is this incredible consistency in the messaging that populists use, really stable over 20 or 30 years. Really surprising. And actually, I was just saying to Andy, I ran the reform literature through this model at the weekend, and actually the same themes kind of pop out. So patriotism and renewal, but it's drenched in the language of ethno-civilizational decline. So Orban was the great kind of preacher of this, but it kind of goes back to the paleoconservatives like Pat Buchanan, back to the French Nouvelle Droite of the 1960s, back to Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West in the 1920s. Very, very long philosophical arc here that unfolds over the course of the last century around ethno-civilizational decline, against which populists put their message of renewal. Second, nostalgia and hunger for something lost. I'm increasingly convinced that this resonates in particular with a sense of what people have lost locally, that river that you used to swim in as a kid, the park where you used to play, the butchers on the high street where you used to buy your sausages. You know, those kind of local things have often gone. And then finally, of course, you know, a characteristic of strongman leaders down the ages, the summons to action, emergency, crisis, struggle that can only be solved by a strongman leader. Now, this kind of enrage and rule messaging works super well on social media. And of course, the amplification of these messages has been transformed by social media, because algorithms do amplify both love and funny pictures of kittens and, you know, whales and that kind of thing, but they also amplify kind of anger, because they're based on algorithms that trigger engagement. We then kind of just tried to map the digital ecosystem of UK populists just to see what would happen. And so we picked sort of three nodes, Mr. Farage, Mr. Godwin, and Reform UK. And those accounts have got about 2 million followers. We scraped 33,000 accounts just to see who those accounts followed. Three quarters of who they followed are not British. They're American populists. So for all of the talk about patriotism and sovereignty, turns out the UK populist system is just another node in an American ecosystem. And that is not an accident, because if you take that old political advice to follow the money, guess what you find? This is a map of about 5,500 transactions which took place over the course of 5 years. You can find this data on Companies House, the Electoral Register, Electoral Commission, Register of Members' Interests, but you put it all together and a couple of things strike you. One, it's a shitload of money. It's £173 million in 5 years. And guess what? It's an underestimate, because since we published these figures in the great newspaper, which is The Guardian, a couple of weeks ago, it's gone up by 25 million, because Mr. Harborne has chucked in another 20 million of cryptocurrency, and then there was the other 5 million that was undeclared. So you're now talking about 200 million in the course of about 5 years. But here's like what's super interesting. Overwhelmingly, this money comes from four places. Legatum, run by Chris Chandler, Paul Marshall, Jeremy Hosking, Chris Harborne. Four men account for the lion's share of this money. And then look where the money's going. It's going into building a media system. GB News is at the heart of it. Money into Reform, think tanks, some more magazines, another crazy right-wing party, conferencing network, more think tanks. A media political complex. And then when you look into why, the theory becomes clear, because these guys have been studying, of all people, Antonio Gramsci. And for those of you who know your Gramsci, you'll know that it's all about, you know, building and fighting a war of position. As Andrew Breitbart said, politics is downstream of culture. And so these folks have very systematically built a media political complex, because they know you've got to win a battle of ideas first. And that is something that has unfolded in plain sight in front of all of us over the last 5 years. So, what do we do about it? So, two thoughts really to kind of leave you with. So, one is the kind of the disposition, the posture. And this is where you can learn a lot from history. So, a lot of people ask me when I was writing the book, is this 1933, you know, is it really as bad as that? Is it all now a disaster? And I kind of concluded that it's not 1933. We're probably about 1927. So you've got some big forces. You've got, you know, the possibility of a stock market crash in the not too distant. But I spoke to a lot of historians about Weimar Germany, and we're blessed, the world is blessed with a lot of brilliant historians of Weimar. And they kind of said, well, look, you know, one of the lessons you've got to learn from the SPD in the early 1930s is the caution, the constitutionalism, the delicate care that they took to defend the Weimar Republic. And it failed dramatically. They were completely outgunned, outboxed, outmaneuvered. But of course, the other politician who was elected in 1933 is Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt rides the tempest. He surfs the tide of anger. He tells us that the only thing we've got to fear is fear itself. He goes into battle with the economic royalists at the time, and he remakes progressive politics for a new era. And I think that is the kind of inspiration that mainstream politics on both left and right could be learning from. Now, that means you've got to underpin that kind of politics with a political strategy that recognises that reform is not one army marching in unison. And there might be a quiz at the end about which of these tribes you are, if you're a reform voter in the audience. But the point I kind of want to make here is that, like, there are some groups of reform voters that are intractable. Like, they're not going to vote for a mainstream party. So trying to set your political messaging against them is nuts. So stop doing that. Think instead about these kind of big groups of voters down here, what we call our melancholy middle, our civic pragmatists, who are in the market for voting for someone else. All in all, about 40% of reform voters are in the market for voting for Labour, Green, Conservative, Lib Dems, you know, not necessarily for reform. So think harder about your political strategy and recognise that amongst these sort of different tribes of reform, these are the different tribes of reform, you know, they've got really different views on whether we need a strong leader. Really big gaps. Different views on climate change. Huge gaps. Look, civic pragmatists, they care about this stuff. Welfare state, NHS, closer relationship with Europe. Civic pragmatists, big fans of Europe. Discussed as disruptors, not big fans of Europe. So, you know, there are ways to kind of divide up and appeal to this coalition in different ways. And so final point, Andy, very quickly, is kind of message to my own party. Which some people are listening to harder than others, I think it's fair to say. But look, we've got to have our own story about national renewal. So people voted for change 2 years ago. They don't feel they got it. So let's be kind of bolder about that story, but let's actually name some enemies. Let's take on the selfish minority, those people who are dodging their dues, shortchanging their workers, ripping you off at the tills and the bills. Let's name them. Let's have a fight about them. The example I always give is Fujitsu. You know, it's a company that caused one of the biggest scandals in British political history that's cost £2 billion, to which they paid literally zero. Let's actually be a bit bolder about leaning into some of those fights. You can come up with a maybe we'll have a contest at the end about a list of enemies. Some people are going to put on Thames Water, because we've done this before. So we've got Fujitsu and Thames Water, and maybe they'll be able to. Second, right, so let's be optimistic about the future. You know, I know it's difficult, but nostalgia is great. But nostalgia is not a strategy. And so this kind of idea of building our future with pride in our past is kind of the politics of where we need to get to. For me, that does take you to a different economic strategy to the one being pursued by this government. I think actually this kind of strategy, although it's got to have some big stories about AI and defence and net zero as big kind of drivers of new jobs, crucially, it's got to have a different settlement for small business, for freelancers, for white van man and woman. That's the only way you're going to rekindle the economics of the high street. And right now, they're being completely screwed by business rates and energy costs and organised crime takeover of the high street. We've got to actually transform the economic environment for small business if that plausible optimism is going to become real. And we've got to couple it with a very, very bold reimagination of the state and the way the state works for new times. If you can't get the state to work, if you can't get in to see your GP, if you can't get the kind of SEN care for your child, you are not going to be optimistic that any kind of change is possible. And it just, it bamboozles me why we haven't got a much bigger and bolder programme of public service reform. Finally, we've got to be the party of kind of strong society, not strong man politics. And that means an era of civic inventiveness, of renewing our civic institutions, rekindling the kind of social capital that brings different kind of communities together, because ultimately that is what is essential if we are to argue for the patriotism of our best ideals. There are values in this country that made this country phenomenal, but they are tolerance, live and let live, pluralism, democracy, the rule of law, all the things that are actually opposed by extremists on the right who refuse to subscribe to the real things that made our country the place it is. So, Andy, that is a very quick whistle-stop tour. I hope it's been food for thought. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you so much, Lynn, for those really interesting remarks. You packed in so many provocations and thoughts into that short space of time. We're going to hear some reactions now, first of all, from Zoe and then from Sarah.
Yeah, I am going to keep to time. That's why I'm looking at my phone. It's not because I'm looking at my phone. I love this book, and I love the fact that it didn't have a segment on left-wing populism, not just because I'm very partisan, in fact, not remotely because I'm partisan, but because in the way we discuss this, we talk about populism as though merely being popular and insurgent makes you a populist.
Yeah, true.
Now,
true.
You could argue that, but in the terms of your argument, in the definitions you give of populist arguments, you know, the decline, the cult of declinism, the purification, the unending struggle, these are the components of fascism. And you can get left-wing fascist as well, but I don't think anybody would describe Zach Polanski as a fascist. I'll take questions on that later. I mean, wow, we got there fast. So I think we have to name it for what it is, and I think we have to say what we're dealing with, and I think we have to say that what we're dealing with is asymmetric polarization. We've spent a long time, I would say probably 15 years, saying, why are their arguments suddenly working? The public doesn't believe the public believes in climate change. The public believes in net zero. How come they've suddenly got an on-the-ground movement against low traffic neighbourhoods? Mm. How come there's this? How come there's that? We look at it and we say, Why does it keep working? And the reason it works is because it is asymmetrically funded, it's because it is asymmetrically amplified, and it is because it is extremely viscerally full of self-belief, full of this viscerally angry self-belief. And there is no similar thing on the left. Until very recently, and I would argue still not. What you've got at the moment is, you know, you've got passionate believers in socialism, but that socialism, kind of last time I checked, didn't take as its presupposition that you had to believe in quite a few conspiracy theories to get there. Whereas you've got a lot of narratives in the new right-wing populism that are nakedly false or conspiracist or misdirecting. And until we recognise that there are value differences between one kind of polarisation and another, and there are value differences between one kind of populist and another, and just before I actually get to the point, I would say that we will help ourselves discuss the Farage tendency. If we stop trying to situate him within a constellation of regular politics and instead situate him as a frontier far-right activist. And when I say far-right, I mean it in the Kasmuda political science sense of this man is a danger. This man is a danger, not on the streets today, but he's a danger to the... Well, he's already done for the Conservative Party. I want to read you this amazing quote by a Republican political strategist called Rick Walker. This is the part the Tories need to understand, sitting there clutching their commemorative Thatcher mugs. You do not absorb a populist movement. The populist movement absorbs you. It eats your donors. It eats your activists. It eats your local associations. It eats your moderates first because they're the most nutritious. Then it eats your conservatives. Then it stands there in your skin and tells everyone it was always there. And that is what has happened in America. And that is what is coming for our conservatives. Now, I never liked the guys, but That's what... I didn't want them to get flesh-eating necrophiliitis. Until we accept that as a thing that's happened, I think we're going to struggle to get to my next bit, which is, you know, we have to stop talking about why people feel so much worse off and start saying you don't have to feel that much worse off because we're going to do a thing which makes you less badly off. And I've listened to this from politicians I admire and sometimes adore. No, that is really stretching it. Let's stick with admire. I've listened to this from politicians I admire as they really, really eloquently and empathetically sketch out why people feel like their own lives are stagnating, why they feel like all their public services are crumbling, why they might feel like they don't like immigrants because they feel that their own citizenship has been so debased and devalued and called into question that how dare anyone else get to feel like a citizen. You know, I've listened to people really talk about this in a compassionate way, but until you start saying your playground is derelict because somebody has walked off with all the money and this is who it is and this is how we're getting it back, you can't... Nobody cares. Nobody wants your arguments. Nobody wants to hear it. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to open any old wounds, but this does go back to the financial crash and it does go back to that era in which there wasn't any money left. And it does go back to us accepting as a political culture for upwards of 10 years that the state could no longer afford a humane aspect towards its disabled and unemployed citizens. It could no longer afford to fund public services. Everything had to be done on the cheap. Everything had to be flogged off. Everything had to continue to function on the backs of the people working in it, who had to have a pay freeze, by the way. And then when things started to go to blow up in their face, when the kind of immovable force of austerity met the immovable object of statutory duty, all you got was just greater and greater state accountability for mistakes of their own making, which they then kicked onto the next guy. It's like this is a direct consequence of the financial crash, the huge amounts of quantitative easing, none of which ended up in normal people's pockets. Everything ended up back with a 0.01%. What we're watching is the erosion of the state by the super wealthy. And you have to either say that or give Farage the keys, because there's no... You can't just explain to people why they feel poorer and why they should be okay about that. Why it's worse to feel racist than it is to feel poorer. You can't... That's not gonna fly. The other thing I think has gone wrong, there's a kind of... In the kind of core components of a fascist narrative, the fifth pillar, after, I think, decline, purification, unending struggle, and the other one that you know and I've forgotten, is the stab in the back narrative, which is where some, you know, this all started because somebody stabbed you in the back. And it's very pronounced in Nazi kind of conceptions. And it was, and that was the, you know, they were stabbed in the back by the apparatchiks at Versailles. But what I think has gone really peculiar, and I think social media has helped, is that our stab in the back, or our right-wing populist stab in the back narrative, is every other politician. So it's almost like they're walking into this bear trap which has been laid to them. Every time they say anything, they're like, you know, you've got Lee Anderson going, look, he's stabbing you in the back again. Look, he just mentioned climate change. It's another stab in the back. And that kind of thing, even if you... There's a kind of strange percolation effect where even if you're not a fan of that kind of person, even if you look at a person like Lee Anderson and kind of instinctively recoil and can see the aggression and the hostility, I mean, I don't know, maybe you are that kind of person, then even within that, if you hear often enough, it's got a gravitational pull. if your stab in the back narrative is every elite politician, it is every politician who's ever told you the European Union was good for your interests. It is every politician who's ever told you that climate change is going to come for us all. If that, you hear this stuff enough, and even if you know it's not true, it kind of has a soothing emollient effect of at least this guy is A, consistent, and B, he's got an answer. Anyway, I'm out of time, so you're lucky to escape points 6 through 10. and over to you.
It's a quite hard act to follow a politician and such an eloquent journalist. Now you get the very boring political science. And I will say, I mean, one of the things I loved about the book is that it takes political science and social science very seriously. And not only, you know, engages with it seriously, but also produces its own, original analysis. And I think it's very rare. I mean, you get political science books and they're boring and no one reads them, like books I write. And then you get sort of passionate political books and they don't have a lot of that sort of rigor, but it's very rare to get that combination of a book that is passionate and original, but also has a very serious kind of evidential analytical foundation. So that's what I liked about the book. I loved the footnotes and all of that stuff.
And I'm sorry, so there's no index.
I did look for the index.
Yeah, there's no.
I will come back to the footnotes.
Yeah.
But so I also think that obviously it couldn't be more timely, and it does get quite passionate at the end, where Liam provides these sort of 10 recommendations that you didn't go into as much detail with. And I was really struck this week that we're all living through how it seems that a lot of people in British politics right now who should really quite seriously read the book if they haven't, and particularly the last point on your 10-point list, which is lead with courage, not caution. And I thought maybe someone in number 10. That would be handy advice. I don't know if he's read it. But anyway. Now, so as Liam has said, it deals with sort of, it's very ambitious. It deals with the demand side, who votes for populists. It deals with the supply side, what is their appeal. And it deals with, you know, the remedy, what's the prescription. So that's a lot to do. And I have one comment on each of these three. So on the demand side, It really is a sort of brilliant summary of a lot of the research that's there, and it presents new evidence. I have some questions about that evidence, and it's not just to be nitpicky, although it is also to be nitpicky, because that's why I'm here. One thing is I'm not a great fan of the sort of marketing types thing, and I certainly don't think these are tribes, because tribes recognize themselves as tribes, yeah? And these people do not recognize themselves. But I see it as a very, you know, it's not to be sort of pedantic. I see it as a helpful heuristic advice, more device to use that, and to think about the nuance, which is exactly right, in people who appeal. It's not just one type of person who vote for the populist right. So I think that's, it's helpful from that perspective. Now, the one question I have about the demand side, which I think is, that's not a criticism, but I guess it's more of a call for where we as social scientists perhaps can be helpful. And that is, when you're describing the appeal which comes from what I think of as a sort of a relative deprivation or relative feel of status loss, how much of that is a real lived experience with it, individualized, and how much of that is a subjective perception that things are really bad and they're worse and they're bad for me and I deserve better. Now, perhaps you say, oh, that doesn't matter, but I think it matters for the remedy part. So we don't, social scientists, we don't do the remedy part, but we perhaps can do some of the analysis. And I'll tell you why it matters, because when I looked at your data, and there's a lot of data like that, it really sort of taps into the subjective sense. And here, of course, there's a strong correlation. But often when we look at objective data, we don't find the strongest correlation between income and and measures of income, and certainly not social class and the populist right. I mean, these things are declining. We find very strong correlations with things like education. And that does raise a question around, what is it? Is it just people feeling, oh, you know, we should be so much better off, or the things that you were touched upon also in the book and in your talk about that you see things around you, why are things declining? Yeah. So maybe I'm sort of okay, but A, I'm not as well off as I had my dad or how I had expected, and my neighborhood is declining. But I think really getting to grips, and again, you know, not for you, but for those of us who have full-time jobs just looking at boring data and not sort of saving the world, for us to sort of think more carefully about that, because it is not, the objective story is not as clear-cut as when you ask people. So when you ask people, of course there's a huge correlation between people feeling they're badly off and people wanting to vote for reform or for Le Pen and so on. But when you actually look at, when you have good data on the objective conditions, that is not as clear. And I partly say that because, you know, you can hear my accent. I come from a country where radical right-wing populism was popular before it became trendy. Denmark, yeah. Denmark is not, you know, a super unequal, super poor country. And so I'm often a little bit scared of this sort of saying, oh, you know, if only we were we redistributed a bit more, you know, these parties wouldn't appeal. That is not, by the way, your book is much more nuanced like that. You really get it that the appeal goes beyond just the economic grievances, but I think it's therefore important to look at. Now, let me, I always like a little bit of tension on the panel, so on the supply side, my second point, let me say left-wing populism. So I told you why it's good that we shouldn't look at left-wing populism, that you don't look at it, but let me nonetheless ask you about it. Now, the reason I fully agree that these are very different beasts, right-wing populism and left-wing populism, and too often we just sort of, oh, these are populists, and they, but they do have things in common, and I wonder there if I would be interested in your sort of your follow-up on this in terms of where, you know, someone like Zach Polanski, he is, you know, a self-declared populist, and where there's something in common is this very clear definition. First of all, we have this pure people, and then we have the evil, corrupt elite. Yeah, that is something that both left-wing and right-wing populism has together. Now, that evil, corrupt elite is very different for left-wing populists, but the easy solutions, which are not there in your book, your prescription are not easy solutions, but is there in elements of left-wing populism, which is, oh, we'll just tack the billionaires, oh, you know, and then it's all solved. Then all the problems go away. And on the right, it's like, oh, if we just get rid of all the immigrants, then it's an easy solution. We can then fund public services. But there are certain things in common. And so my sort of question for you is, now that, of course, we know that the greatest threat to Labour, or maybe not threat, maybe not, that's, I guess, my question for you, is more from the Greens electorally than from Reform, not threat necessarily to the country, but sort of electorally to your coalition, then are they a part of a progressive coalition? Is that how you see them? Or are they part of, in a sense, the enemy to be beaten? Now, this is not something social scientists can answer. We can just sort of categorize, but it's something I'm interested in. And then finally, my final point is about your remedy. So there's a great part of the book that really, which is very hard, that tries to look at, okay, so what can the... have this idea of the sort of the radical center do better. And that relates to the point about both left and right-wing populism. Now, one of the things that both left and right-wing populism does successfully is about identity building. Yeah. So when you're that person who feels, I don't have the self-esteem anymore, I should have, because I'm not, you know, you have felt this status loss. Why am I not in my life where I should be? Why am I neighborhood not? That sense of loss of pride that you describe, they give you something else. Let's say, oh, I'm a young male. Well, you know, white male. Well, you should be better off. And you get that identity through being your self-esteem by being a white native male, for example. Yeah, there's something in that. Now, part of what of the appeal of populism that in the identity and in the tribal aspect, there's an out-group.
Yeah.
There's something you are that is superior, and there's something you're not. There's that other that is inferior to you. Now, is there an other in your identity? Or maybe you don't want another. But you said, you had in your talk, you had, oh, we can make a list of others. But does Thames Water work to give me an identity that I don't like? And I'm not, And maybe that is part of the appeal, but I do think that it is something that is harder as an identity narrative when you have a beautiful section on patriotism that I loved and as a naturalized Brit, although he does want to say that, but Liam does want to have a probationary citizenship.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
and there's a lot on fish and chips.
Would I pass?
And beer.
I felt I would have passed the probationary period, but yeah, no, that was I felt a little controversial.
I don't think I would pass.
Made me a bit, but you don't need to, but I needed to. But so as a, you know, like the converts, so I converted to British, becoming British, so they are always the strongest believer. And there's a beautiful chapter on section on patriotism, and I was like, this is beautiful, I'm British, it's great. Now if I passed Liam's test. But the point is, you know, where's the other? And that's sort of, I wanted to ask you about that. And then just finally coming back to the part about supply. We are entering in Britain, which we've known in Europe for decades, a period of very fragmented politics. I'm not sure, based also on the data you talk about in the book, that we're going to get back to the era of great party politics. So who is in your coalition? It was very much a prescription that seemed like, oh, Labour will just go back and capture, you know, the great majority once we... And maybe your book will be that successful, that will happen, 50-plus. But if it's not, we know from the data that there is a majority out there that might vote for other parties, like the Greens or the Lib Dems or Plaid Cymru or SNP. You know, that is the... Are they in your coalition? And sort of how are you thinking about your prescriptions here, because it seems very one party idea as opposed to how I think we've been used to thinking about it in Europe for a long time, that we need to think about how we build coalitions, not just across different types of voters, but also across different types of parties. So with that, anyway, read the book, go and buy it afterwards, because it's also a great read.
It is, it's a great read.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thanks so much, Zoe and Sarah, for those really probing and I think different and complementary kind of reflections on Liam's book. We're actually not doing too badly for time, so I think we have time to give Liam a few minutes just to respond, reflect on some of those remarks, and then we will open up to the audience.
Okay, great. Wow, that's absolutely really quite thought-provoking stuff. So let me just try and summarise this in three very quick points, which I think I kind of understated. So Zoe's point about asymmetry is not... I haven't thought about it like that, but you're right. I mean, it's not, you know, I've talked about asymmetric fragmentation in the kind of the vote, but the way you describe asymmetric funding, asymmetric amplification, asymmetric money, you know, asymmetric belief. That is, I think that's actually a very potent way of helping us kind of understand this sort of moment that we're in. And I think you're also kind of right to just kind of wind back to why everything changed with the financial crash. And you brought in quantitative easing, which is kind of super important. So the prequel to the book, The Inequality of Wealth, kind of makes this point that what we've basically had in Britain now, and the wound that both populist voters on the left and right share, is that they're really angry about the inequality of progress that's characterised our country since 2010. And, you know, the World Economic data basically shows that the top 1% in Britain have grown their wealth by about 31 times more than everybody else. Why is that? Well, £850 billion worth of quantitative easing kind of helps. That held down interest rates by almost 1 point. That accounts for maybe 2/3 of the wealth growth that we had in our country. Who owned that wealth? Well, the top 1%. What tax did they pay on that? Well, how many people here have read Rishi Sunak's tax return? What, like none of you? Okay, so it's me and Andy. Okay, well, it's lucky me and Andy are here. It's not very long. It's only like a page, isn't it? I mean, it's like a one-page statement.
It's not actually the tax return.
And it's not actually the tax
return. It's the accountant's account of the tax return. Something. I would like to see the real tax return.
Yeah. So what it shows is basically income of 2 million, and the tax rate was 23%. So how can you earn 2 million quid and pay 23% tax? Well, you know, as Andy's work kind of shows, you know, if you get that money from capital gains. So we've put in 850 billion of quantitative easing. The gains of that have gone overwhelmingly to the wealthiest. We've then taxed that at half the rate of top rate tax. But we all pay for that quantitative easing because to unwind it costs about 103 billion, which is a cost that falls on the general taxpayer. So it's... So kind of Zoe's sort of right to kind of say this kind of inequality of progress is like that was a state decision, but it's not something that many of my colleagues kind of call out as one of the great kind of co-creators of this kind of moment that we're in now, and it's why the debate on wealth tax has got to actually gain strength rather than disappear over the years to come, and Andy's work has helped us set that out. Second point, on the demand side, so this is a very, very thought-provoking question. So the way that we did this research was to basically try and dial into the behavioural economics that tells us that the social theory of wealth is a bit more revealing. So most reform voters are actually median income and median wealth. So they're not the poorest, they're kind of in the middle. But they feel that others have done much better than them, both globally and sort of nationally. And so when you then kind of ask, do you get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work? No. Are you treated with dignity in the workplace? No. Are your views respected? No. So this kind of wound of indignity, I think, is kind of more revealing. And so I think the sort of social theory of wealth tells us a lot more about this. And it is a subjective rather than an objective thing. You're absolutely right to kind of flag that. But the reason this is so important in explaining the politics of today is that we are in a world of slow economic growth, which means that politics becomes zero sum. And so if I think that you have gained something that you shouldn't have given I work so hard, I should have had it, then you're going to have these distributional battles.
You're going to deport me.
All the time. Well, which is, you know, the reform solution, right?
Yeah, exactly.
After sort of putting you in camps in places like Hodge Hill, which is sort of, you know... and so that's why, in a way, my kind of last point is that we can't, I don't think, magically escape zero-sum politics. We can try and grow the economy faster, but if you look at all the kind of forecasts globally and for the UK, we're in a, you know, we're not returning to pre-crash growth. And so the battles are going to become distributional, and that means you've got to name your enemies. And if you... And that's why you've got to, I think, learn that lesson from Roosevelt, and in particular his kind of Madison Garden speech, which I think is about 1935, when he kind of begins really railing against the vested interest in America and says, you know, words to the effect of, these people hate me, well, I tell you, I welcome their hatred. You know, he is prepared to kind of lean into a big ugly battle with the vested interest that he thinks is holding back America. And I just think that you can define the trade-offs in your terms, and you can take account of those who have done really well over the last 10 to 15 years and take on those vested interests with a new kind of, frankly, aggression, or others will name the struggle of distribution in different terms, which are in ways that are actually counter to our values. And, you know, I don't believe in the politics of othering, because I think, you know, mainstream politics on both left and right has to be all in it together. And that is key to us building the kind of social capital and the civic inventiveness that we're going to need to get us through what is going to be a very bumpy decade ahead. But thank you, that was brilliant. Brilliant.
Great. Well, we are at the stage of this evening where we get to hear your comments, carefully disguised as questions. hopefully some questions as well. So we have an audience both here and online. If you're here in person and you wish to ask a question, then please raise your hand, and then when I indicate, you can speak. I am going to insist that questions do actually conclude with a question, even if there's a bit of comment in there. And please don't take offence if I cut you short if you're going on too long. That's just because we do want to give an opportunity to have as many questions as we can. If you're online, then please type your questions into the Q&A box. I'm going to have my eye out for my colleague Peter, who is going to be looking at those questions as they come in, and I'll pass over to him to read some of them out. Whether you're in person or online, if possible, can you please start by giving your name and affiliation? So who would like to ask the first question? I'm only looking for people who have their hands up. there's someone in the front here in the blue and white striped top. Someone on the balcony right at the front. And someone, I think, waving a Tribune essay collection, which gives him the right to ask the third question.
I know, it's the disguise of a flyer.
Okay, so there's three there. I'll collect them together and then hear Liam's thoughts. So.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was really interesting to hear, and I don't think I'd pass the British citizenship test because I don't drink, so I don't know. but as I was hearing all of your comments, I kept thinking about the horseshoe theory, right? That about populism and essentially how left and right populism can kind of merge to a certain extent with that amplification of the other and the enemy. When we talk about the current situation, and I'm an immigrant, and I'm at LSE, so I'm doing my master's here, and again, I'm not someone who's been here for a while. And I hear the kind of conversations going around, okay, you know, immigrants are stealing our jobs, immigrants have spent, you know, we're paying so much money. I mean, immigrants pay a lot of money to this economy. So I think about the packaging, right, and how essentially the right has been able to package, especially the reform has been able to package an enemy in a really articulate, clear, simple manner. And when we talk about, you know, labor in general, it feels very fragmented. Like, what are you for? I'm not clear what Labour does, essentially. I know what Tories do, I know what Reform does, I know what Green does, but I don't know what Labour does, essentially. Yeah. So I think I would really want to hear your perspective on the packaging part and how, what can you do better as a party to make sure that everyone understands what you're for?
Yeah, great question.
And the gentleman at the front of the balcony?
Melville Rodriguez. What are the solutions to accelerate economic growth in the UK?
And the gentleman waving the book.
Okay.
it's just a leaflet. Victor Mallet from the FT, and I've also just written a book on the far right in France. I was kind of really intrigued by your, I think it was your second slide, where you showed, you know, all the world's and Europe's far right leaders together. And I just wanted to ask you two questions, really. One is, you know, what are the kind of links between those far-right or populist-right parties? You know, how do they cooperate other than just receiving money from the US and perhaps some social media assistance from the US? And then the second part of it is your business of solutions. Yeah. Are the left, liberals, the centre, are they cooperating across borders internationally to try and counter that massive rise that we see across Europe of the far-right parties? Thanks.
Great question.
Great. Liam, I'll let you take those in the order that you wish.
Okay. Let's do it like this. So look, I think one of the great things, actually, is when you kind of build these kind of models to analyse the semantics, you can then, I discovered at the weekend, it's like how I relax at the weekend, you can then kind of run election literature through it to kind of see what sort of pops. And so I did reform, and the reform literature basically, it triggers almost perfectly all of those three tropes that I showed. And then the green literature is a little different, but when you do the two together, what it basically shows you is that reform captures the anger and the Greens capture the hope. And then, you know, I sort of, with great trepidation, I thought, oh, shit, I better put the Labour literature through it as well and see what happens. And basically what you get, it's kind of to your point, really, you get it's a bit meh. It's a bit. This is no criticism of party staff, I should say. This is all down to the politicians. But it's just not. We're kind of marooned between the anger and the hope, right? And so we're in this business because we were invented by the working class as a collective force to advance working class interests, because we believe that through the strength of our common endeavour, we achieve more than we achieve alone. That's clause 4 of the Labour Party Constitution. That is what we believe in. And so we believe that you can basically advance everybody's freedom through effective cooperation. That's kind of what it kind of comes down to. But the way that we talk about that, explain that, the way that we narrate our pride in our past as a guide to what we're doing in the future is really, really poor right now. And you can't behave like that in today's world of digital division. But I guess I've also come to the conclusion that you can't get a cut through now unless you're prepared to engage in battles. And, my old boss, Tony Blair, he was actually sort of supremely good at kind of thinking that he needed battles. He needed to kind of stage battles. He got kind of quite carried away with it, as some of you remember, in kind of staging these kind of battles, but in order to get his points to kind of cut through. And that is why I sort of think you do need a kind of a good populism in a way. And I think good populism on the left is a kind of an economic populism. So Pepper Called Pepper, actually, at Blavatnik, has written a very good book about this that has just come out recently, which I would also kind of recommend to people, which kind of makes this point. You know, there is a moment here. There was a moment actually after the financial crash when, you were tilting at this, sorry, I think, but, there weren't many bankers in handcuffs going to jail, right, no. after the financial crash. And so... And that was the beginning of a sense that the elites are just kind of getting away with it. Now, on the kind of economic growth, I should kind of advertise my Substack at this point. So if you're on Substack, Liam Byrne, Substack is where you can find us. So, what we're deliberately trying to do on the Business and Trade Committee is kind of set out exactly what that economic growth story looks like. So we're kind of fans of mission-driven growth, but we do think you've got to remake the institutions of our economy in order to deliver it. Crucially, you've got to couple it with a radical new settlement for small business, entrepreneurs, high streets, freelancers. That is where we think a lot of the economic growth comes from. But then you've also got to completely remobilise the investment side of the economy. And that's a big report that we're publishing out in kind of 2 or 3 weeks. So by the summer, we'll have published a kind of a body of work, which we think is actually both a pretty good diagnostic, but also a pretty good prescription for where we want to go. And then Victor's point, I mean, this is just so interesting, isn't it? So CPAC obviously brought together the authoritarian right populace in a really significant way. And the funding story helps you, is revealing. So some of the money going into right-wing populism is obviously very dark. It's coming from the Russian intelligence service. It's coming in through cryptocurrency now into through proxies. CIA estimates that's about, what, 30 million a year, I think. But actually unheralded is the American Christian right is putting 30 million a year into European populists as well. So, you've got a lot of money, as well as all that money I've just sort of pointed to offshore, that is coming in as well. So it's a very well kind of articulated system, and things like Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, CPAC, are bringing that together. Now, it's taken the left a long time to kind of catch up, but what was super impressive about Prime Minister Sanchez in Spain a couple of weeks ago was kind of bringing together the global left in Barcelona. And I would say the policy prescriptions are kind of 60 to 70% there, so they've got a way to go. But my goodness, there was energy and sizzle in the room. And so that kind of global progressive mobilization is really, I think, beginning to start. It was exciting. And, one of the things I'm saying to our party is, look, if we're going to take the G20 presidency next year, which is what we are, let's have a road to the G20. And actually, let's kind of pick up the baton from Sanchez and think about how we kind of carry that forward now. So I think the right has been a long way ahead of us. I'm sorry to tell you, there is a global right-wing conspiracy, in case no one had kind of noticed. And it's got a lot of money. It's got a lot of money in it,
Peter, we'll take, I think, one question from online, and then I'll be looking for two more from the audience. So you can put up your hands now while in the audience whilst Peter takes one from online.
We've got one question online from Antonio, who's a visitor at LSE. He asks, would the situation be improved if we put restrictions on big money and donations entering politics altogether?
Yeah, great. So there is someone in the white jumper just toward the back of the lower row, and then the gentleman in the red T-shirt up at the back in the corner on the balcony.
So my question is that I think with right-wing populism, I guess the appeal is change that can be achieved in the short term. Yeah. But a party like Labour offering progress, I think a lot of the change that they promise needs the long term to be achieved. So I guess my question is how to bring people along on that journey and trust and ask people to trust that that change can actually be achieved.
Yeah, great question.
Love it so far. It's all been really good. Simon Kelly, I'm a financial advisor. Given that sort of by definition you're talking to a group of critical thinkers who've bothered to turn up here this evening, how do we change it rather than just talk about it?
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
Okay. So we've got question about political donations, how do we bring people along on the journey, and change, not talk.
Okay, well, I'd be very interested in Zoe Sorin's view on all of this, but I mean, I think, so there's a number of us who have been campaigning on the influence of Russia in British politics since about 2018, and, you know, we've been kind of calling for these kind of bans on foreign money donations for a long time. Banning cryptocurrency donations, at least for now, is obviously a sensible thing to do. You know, this is going to make me sort of deeply, deeply unpopular, but, you know, I have come to the conclusion that ultimately you're going to need state financing of political parties if you really want to clean up politics. You're going to need big caps on big donations to really kind of clean up politics. I don't think the public is going to be in the market for that anytime soon, and so, you know, the elections bill that is going through is going to get us a chance to do a bunch of this stuff. I think the thing that I worry about, though, is that if you're not kind of regulating the media money, then yeah, are we really going to fix this?
Now, well, I have thoughts on this, but you finish, because it's your book.
Okay, all right, well, I'll finish really quickly. So this point about short-term, long-time is so, so important. And so, you know, I've been doing thousands of steps a day over the last kind of few weeks on the doors in my patch, and I actually think that if you want to persuade people that change is possible in the short term, you've actually got to focus first on the change they see outside their front door. And what happened with COVID is that after COVID, you know, we used to have that kind of old saying, all politics is local, but after COVID, like, changed a lot of it. After COVID, politics became hyper-local. And that kind of space between your front door, the green space where you walk the dog, and the shop where you buy your milk, that kind of triangle is like a lens through which you look at the world. And if it's in chaos, then you think your life is bad and your progress is not moving. So I actually think that you've got to change that hyper-local stuff first in order to kind of change the lens through which people kind of look in the world. And actually, that stuff isn't gigantically expensive. You can make an impact on that sort of pretty quickly. And I think so a good example of one of the mistakes the government is making at the moment is we have this big kind of program called Pride in Place. It's about $4.5 billion. It's really important. It's significant. But the money doesn't start flowing until 2028. You know, the money should start flowing like on day one, you know, if you really wanted to kind of affect this. And then finally, how do you change things? I mean, the book is kind of written, I mean, folk are very kind about the sort of the 10 points at the end, you know, which are ideas I kind of drew together by talking to people a lot smarter than I am. And what I'm kind of hoping to do by getting out and talking about this is to kind of say, well, look, is that right? Is it wrong? What needs adding? What needs kind of subtracting? Because, you know, I think it's kind of inevitable that there's going to be sort of quite a lively debate, at least in the Labour Party, about where the direction of the government goes in the months and years ahead. I think the Conservative Party is beginning to have that debate, actually. So what is that new thing they've said? A Prosper UK?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's some quite nice people in that, right? Okay, they're nice. So I think, and the Conservatives, you know, are in real trouble. I mean, as Zoe said, they're in real trouble. So I do believe that politics is a battle of ideas. And so I am kind of hoping that over the next kind of 6 to 7 months, we can get really kind of clear about this, so that by the time we get to the next election, which will be in May next year, people can start voting for it. But all I would say is there's no substitute for good people getting involved in politics, standing as candidates, and making the case themselves. And it is sort of tough right now, but you know, your ability to make an impact as a candidate now is actually sort of quite significant, and politics needs you right now.
Yeah, I mean, I want to just briefly talk about funding of the media and funding of think tanks and all the rest of it, because I want to come back on what you were saying about choose your, you know, is it a serious proposition just tax the billionaires? What if you taxed them 90%? What if they gave you however many billions that would be? It wouldn't actually change the material. You know, you could give everybody a fiver, so what? The problem with extremely rich people is not just that they have a lot of money, it is also that in the elite overproduction, they buy themselves into political structures that they have no democratic right to. And we've seen this in really profound ways. You know, the insertion of billionaires into mature democracies is a weird thing. They used to go into autocracies because it was a good way of protecting their wealth, but now they're coming into mature democracies, and we're saying this not just in the US but also in Germany and India, and they don't just buy themselves political position, they buy themselves political heft with GB News and the Daily Mail and the Telegraph, and they change the political weather, and it's scary to watch. And it's scary having to argue with people from the BBC about why they get their news agenda from the front pages of the newspapers, and that's the way they've always done it. But it means currently they're getting their news agenda, which is 75% in the service of the interests of billionaires. That's why we need to curtail their wealth. It's not because I want a piece of it, even though if I got a piece of it, I wouldn't complain. And I think apart from the elite overproduction, there is, alongside it, they have a huge asymmetry of impact. They have an asymmetry, their views have way too much impact on our cultural space. They have way too much impact on working conditions because they set them. They have way too much impact on house prices because this money is of no object to them. And it's basically like an algae formation in a pond. I think they've destroyed the ecosystem. So that is why I think capping political donations is necessary but insufficient. They don't even limit themselves. You know, when you can put 5 million quid in the back pocket of Nigel Farage, you do not need to sprinkle around your donor formations to make sure that you don't get pinged with it. We're in new waters, is my view.
Yeah, totally right.
I think we've got another round of questions. This time again, I'll take one online and then two from the in-person audience.
Yes, we've got two questions online, both asking, how have the long-term socio-economic impacts of the 2008 financial crash led to the growth in populism we see today?
And then I'll take one question from the front row here, and the person who has both hands up has managed to attract my attention, so well done.
So thanks for this discussion, it's been wonderful. Liam, I wanted to follow up on your point about that meeting in Barcelona of the progressive left, because this is something that we've been sort of thinking about at the LSE as well. We had, in previous contexts, we'd have a roadmap, call it Washington Consensus, call it neoliberalism. We had the third way, we had like a vision. And it's not just down to Keir Starmer that he hasn't articulated a vision. We see these things in other countries in Europe as well. This morning I was listening to news about Merz's government in Germany, and it's exactly the same picture. Yeah. There's no articulation of a clear progressive way forward. Yeah. And it shouldn't be that hard to do, given climate change, population aging, all these things. Why haven't we articulated anything in this direction, and was that progressive meeting that you attended in Barcelona a step in that direction?
Yeah.
My name is Yu Yin. Thank you for the excellent discussion. And my question is, if populism is often a symptomatic response to a crisis of representation in liberal democracy in Britain, so does beating them require us to fix the policy outcomes or to fundamentally redesign how we define the people as a definition in the age of hyper-globalization? Thank you.
Very interesting. Okay. So the last question, I'm not sure about the answer to the last question. That is a very interesting question that I would like to think about a little bit more. But it comes back, I think, to the way you use patriotism. So, you know, if you're, you know, if you're kind of thinking about how do you rekindle social capital, how do you kind of find new ways to bring it together, then you are, you know, inclusive patriotism can help you. As long as you kind of use tradition as a living invitation to come and join in and help reshape things, as long as you don't treat tradition as a kind of a dead ideal from the past that you just kind of salute on cold days. And some of that patriotism is like local, you know. And, you know, when I was at the tail end of my time as immigration minister, I was trying to work out, you know, what did it mean to be British? And so I took the Home Office around the country to kind of ask people, well, you know, what is the deal? And basically people said, look, you know, as long as people kind of work hard and pay tax and obey the law and make an effort to speak English, it should be live and let live. People are actually sort of pretty tolerant about what the deal should be. But the other thing that was really remarkable about that is the way I was kind of playing with this idea of a Britain Day. Should we have a Britain Day in which people kind of celebrate being British? And if so, how would you celebrate that? And obviously, you know, there was a lot of people that just said, well, you would spend that day in the pub for sure. But what was really interesting about it is the number of kind of local traditions that then kind of popped up. People talk about sort of very, very local traditions, you know, whether it's kind of cheddar rolling or some of the kind of weird stuff they do, and I won't go into the weird stuff. But I mean, you know, people have got kind of quite interesting kind of local traditions. So how you kind of define that, I think, is very different in different places. I guess I don't think we quite know the answer to your question, but I think there's got to, and that's why I call it civic inventiveness. We've got to go and be inventive for kind of 10 or 15 years to figure out how to do this again. So I think it's a very thoughtful question. And then on the LSE, Barcelona, where does all that go? I mean, it's the most exciting thing that I've seen. It is values-based, so that's good. It is about defending democracy, rule of law, tolerance, pluralism, and all of those great things that makes Europe great. It's not quite there on the economics, is the truth. And that has still got a bit of a way to go, and it's not being wholly honest about actually the need for rearmament and the need to step up to a predatory Russia. And it's not quite being honest enough about tax either, because there is still a notion that you can borrow your way through this. And actually, I just think that is for the birds. I just think we're going to need a different kind of tax settlement, which is why things like wealth taxation are going to be an important part of the future. And then on the long-term interest, you know, affecting the economic crash, I mean, I do think this is where, you know, Andy's work has been so important, because it's helped us kind of understand that since the financial crash, asset prices have continued to accelerate while wage growth has stayed, you know, really poor. And so the kind of the wealth to wages curve has been completely changed. And so, you know, when I was born in the holy town of Warrington back in 1970, you know, the net wealth of the country was about 3 times the national labour income. Now it's about 9 times the national labour income, which just means that assets are so much more expensive compared to wages. That, I mean, like, is anybody here from Gen Z?
Yes. I've got a work experience person.
Right. Like, what are you going to do? It's, like, really tough. It's, like, really tough. I mean, you're smiling now.
It's in the book.
I know, it's sad, right? And so unless, you know, inequality of wealth, which the previous book calls for something called universal basic capital, which basically helps capitalise young people from a fund that's funded by wealth tax, you know, unless we kind of fix, unless we kind of zero in on how we get generational spread of assets in a really big way, I think these divides are going to get worse, don't you?
Well, what's going to happen is there's going to be a massive intergenerational transfer of wealth when people start dying.
Yeah.
But all that will do is intensify inequality between people who previously might have been friends.
I think there's about $5.5 trillion that transfers boom is dying.
Yeah, I'm in favour of 100% inheritance tax. It really solves that problem.
That would solve that problem.
I mean, you can hiss at me all you want.
On the question on the financial crisis, and I mean, that's what the evidence shows. It's also in Liam's great book, that it did lead to a rise of the populist right. That's a great it's in the beginning. But also, it also led to a more general fragmentation. It also led to a rise of the radical left. Yeah. It just generally meant that people have, you know, they're no longer so attracted to the centre-left or the centre-right. I mean, the centre-left sort of ironically suffered more.
Yeah, did suffer.
And ironically in that, why don't you go to Labour when, you know, when you're seeing the failure of capitalist institutions? But in a sense, you gave the answer, didn't you, that it's not so ironic because who was it who propped up the capitalist institutions with taxpayers' money, partly the centre-left.
Yeah. Well, that's why, I think, is why you're seeing so much anger with the Labour Party now. It's because I don't think it is against... I don't think it's personal against Keir, even though it's expressed incredibly personally. And I only realised that 2 days ago, because I have beef with him. I didn't have huge animus against Jeremy Corbyn, so I would look at people hating him and think, what the hell do they hate about him personally? And then when people hated Keir personally, I thought, oh yeah, I can see that. But, it's only like, suddenly dawned on me that nobody's angry in that personal, visceral way with either of them. It's about the Labour Party, and it's about the Labour Party because, I don't think it is a propping up system. They were the party before the militants were quashed who went after capital. Mm. And if they don't go after it, nobody goes after it.
Yeah.
But that's not your fault. That's not on you.
No, but I think there's a, you know, there's, again, this is, I don't think, certainly the debate I see inside our party at the moment is honest enough about this. So, you know, we can see all of those kind of dynamics that I've just described about wealth inequality. You know, and I've gone to the lengths of writing a book about that. But equally, you know, people are so worried about how do you raise the investment rate in the economy at the same time. We have the lowest investment rate in the G7, now second lowest. And so, to get the top rate of investment in the G7, we have to mobilise 180 billion a year. That's how big the gap is, right? And so there's a kind of a genuine anxiety about how do you discourage that investment if you're also going after wealth taxation. Now, I think there is a way to do it. I think you have to kind of remake your public finance institutions, and this report we're bringing out shortly will describe how you do that. But I just don't think we've thought about that dilemma hard enough and figured out the trade-offs that are going to be needed.
Yeah.
But I'm now convinced there is a way to do it.
Yeah.
Right, I think we have time for one more round of questions, and I'm going to take three from the room, but...
He's got a torch.
We've got more and more elaborate attempts to attract my attention. I would like to hear on some topics and perspectives that maybe we've not heard so much from so far. So I'm going to try to give preference to questions either from people who have, maybe you don't want to say you've voted for reform, but you can certainly say that, or you're reform sympathetic in some way. I want to hear some challenge to Liam from... Now, a lot of hands have gone down now. And another is, I'm curious that we haven't heard that much about Brexit. So if there are any Brexit-related questions, then now's your chance on those. Okay, so gentleman in the beige top, white hair, the person with the necklace waving their hand there on the bottom, and somebody at the back who's waving another pamphlet.
So question would be, how do you deal with, assuming that populism actually gains more and more ground, how do we capitalize, in a sense, on that? Andrew Jackson was a big populist in the United States. He had a lot of issues, overrode the Supreme Court, things that we've been seeing recently. But at the same time, he did a lot for the Little Red Schoolhouse and the development of the West. So how can we capitalize on populism if parts of it are inevitable?
Great question.
Thank you. Oh, it does work. I am not a Brexit questioner or a reform voter. I'm frankly, I'm just one of the many Gen Z who will never own a house. But my question is about the recent elections, and given the fragmented results, do you think this truly is the end of the two-party system, or do you think whenever the next general election is, this year, next year, who knows, it will just go back to the same one or maybe two government parties and one main opposition?
Yeah, great question.
Hi. Do you reckon the Manchester by-election from February, which I heard was bad for Labour, was about populism? Do you reckon any of it could have been about Palestine? And it, do you think, does that mean that like Palestine is like a populist issue? Or like, yeah, what does that mean?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should I
kick off on that?
Yes, please do.
Okay. So how do we capitalise on it? So I guess, you know, my sort of observation about the authoritarian populist we've got today, and we've skillfully avoided the definitional question here about how you define authoritarian populism, which is not easy. And the book kind of, you know, comes up with a sort of slightly lazy conclusion, which is it's a bit like pornography in that you know it when you see it. But one of the things that kind of characterises authoritarian populism in the West right now is that it's appeasement when it comes to Russia. It's authoritarian in terms of its prescription at home, but it's avaricious everywhere. So that kind of appeasement abroad, authoritarianism at home, avarice everywhere, is like a common issue. And we've not really talked about the kind of kleptocratic influences that, you know, appear to characterise a lot of populist leaders. And so, you know, one of the ways in which I think you would end up capitalising on it is a little bit like Hungary, is that you do get counter-kleptocratic forces. And if you can kind of get a hardening of democratic capitalism against kleptocratic forces, then that actually is one of the prizes. We'll see how Peter Magyar gets on in kind of rooting out sort of Orbanism from political economy in Hungary. We've already got, you know, steps here in the UK to transform election finance reform, partly because what we can see going on in and around reform. So, you know, maybe I'm being naive, but I think actually that is one of the counterforces that would be a good thing that we're going to see. Is it the end of the two-party system? I think is a great question. So I think we are in the death throes of the two-party system. Sarah might contradict me, but I think we're in the death of the two-party system, but we're at the beginning of the two-block system. And so how block politics now unfolds is going to be kind of messy. I think it's going to take a couple of election cycles to settle down. And I think what you're going to get at the next election is that I suspect that reform is going to continue conquering the right. I think on the left you're going to get a bit of consolidation, you know, and I can see that in seats like my own. But I don't think that's going to be the complete story. And so I do think you may end up with more coalition politics at different bits of the British state. And quite where it lands, you know, I don't know. And that's why one of the reasons why the debate about proportional representation is going to kind of really grow in intensity. And then on Palestine, I don't think Palestine's a populist issue. I think Palestine is a human rights issue. And I think that, you know, the Labour Party, certainly before the election, failed to take the right stance on Palestine. It was, you know, I've only broken the whip once in 22 years of being a Labour MP. I broke the whip on that issue. And the Labour Party in government has still got a long way to go on getting it right. And there's a lot that we can learn from both the Spanish government and the Irish government. And quite frankly, that change of position should start with a clear ban on goods from illegal settlements. And that is something that we could do tomorrow.
Okay, we are right out of time, unfortunately, but that was, I thought, a fantastic discussion. Really great set of questions as well from the audience. Thanks again so much, Liam, for your account of your book, and to Zoe and Sarah for your
comments. The book, may I remind you, is available outside to purchase, and Liam will be sticking around for a little while, I think, to sign copies if you wish. So please do avail yourselves of that opportunity. Thanks again, and have a great evening. Great.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.